Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast, where we connect with educators from across the globe who are creating a better future for learning and educating now by implementing bold ideas and fostering a sense of curiosity, creativity, and possibility.
Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast. I'm your co-host, Joshua Faden, here with Michael Carson. Our guest today is the amazing thought leader, Caroline Hill, who is the founder of 228 Accelerator in Washington, D.C., and has been doing wonderful work in the region on creating equity projects within education. And so without further ado, let me turn it over to Caroline. I'd love to just hear a little about you, who you are, and kind of your journey in this space here.
Sure. Thanks, Josh. Thank you so much for having me and showcasing our work today. I think I probably will start my origin story, how I came to the work, not necessarily planning to be an educator or planning to be a teacher. I graduated studying engineering and came to DC in 1999, a long time ago in the other century. As an engineer and worked at two companies that no longer exist. One's called Anderson Consulting, and the other company was Bell Atlantic, and was creating, was working in their some of their software development as, the whole industry was migrating to the internets and all of the things. But one of the habits that I maintained when I was working in the private sector was going to work and tutor after school, just to kind of feed my soul a bit. And when I was in walking to some of the schools in DC, and this is in the 99-2000s, and tutoring students, I realized that there were students that were learning things and they were 16 and 17 that I actually learned when I was in seventh grade. And I was that's interesting, not really putting any judgment on it, but I was like, that's interesting. But as I transitioned out of the private sector, I did some work as an AmeriCorps Vista in Baltimore, saw the same pattern, and then had to make a decision, how was I going to spend my time and my talent and the privilege that I had in this particular moment, and decided to quit my job and become a teacher, knowing nothing about it, but quickly learning, very, very quickly. So if you can imagine one day being an engineer, the next day being a science teacher, that was literally my life, and learning how to learn pedagogy and all the things. But it was probably the best decision that I made. My family was like, what are you doing? And it's one of those, you have those moments in your life where you don't know, you just know you got to keep moving and keep walking. Like, it doesn't make sense, but I know this is the right thing. And those were some of the most exciting. I mean, I learned so much about myself, learned so much about things that I did not know. To make a long story short, was a teacher and then moved into leadership and had the privilege and opportunity to start a charter high school and be the founding principal. And those experiences only come once in your lifetime. And my mentor at the time was like, "That you're not going to get that again. Take it. Yeah. It comes once. And if you don't take it when it comes, then it might not come back again." And that was, my first introduction to really designing and building something from the ground up. And we weren't calling it design. We weren't even calling it innovation. This was in 2011, 2012. But what I will say is that 2 to 3 years into my principalship, I was noticing that the same pattern that I saw when I was tutoring was showing up in my school. And that was shocking to me. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm woke. I'm black. This is not supposed to happen. Not supposed to happen to me or my wife, and all the dissonance, right, came up. Mm-hmm. And then that was when I said, I need to be really, really thoughtful about who did I build this school for? What were my assumptions about the students in this school? And how were my assumptions about the students in the school problematic? And what do I need to do about them? And realize that a lot of the structures that we had put in place were for a minority of students in the school, not the majority. and they were for minority in schools who had more privilege and power than it were the majority. And not saying that, you know, the work that we did wasn't work, wasn't a lot of good work. We were kind of figuring out as we went. And I think the greatest gift and opportunity that we did as a staff was to say, like, there's some things we need to change about the way we're working together. And there's some things we need to change about even how we're delivering curriculum. So we did things like we shifted our curriculum from being driven by teachers to being student-centered and having it be self-paced and competency-based. I mean, like, even those technical moves created opportunities for kids who had never, ever, ever experienced success in an algebra class to master content and concepts, right? To really start to change who they saw themselves as people. But, you know, like, what we also realize is that, you know, it's really hard to push up against the system, because once you start tinkering around the edges, like, how long a child is supposed to take to master content. Like, it's like they could do it in a shorter amount of time, but we don't have very many policies that allow them to do it in a longer amount of time without it compromising other ways that we use to measure success of schools in our education institutions. So I exited the principalship, got the first class out, and they're like adults now, which is crazy to see them on the street. Yes. This idea of like design and equity and justice didn't leave me so quickly, right? It became a personal and both professional obsession. And a lot of those experiences as a principal became the foundation of the Equity by Design framework. More finer lines around that framework were drawn when I started the DC Equity Lab. And I was like, well, I don't really know what the intersection is between race and equity and justice, but let's build something to find out, right? So the DC Equity Lab built something to find out. And it was like, and this is how easy it is to build something. We're just like, okay, let's figure out what happens when we have conversations about race and equity at the public library and leave it open to people. Are people going to come? We don't know, right? So it was like small things that didn't cost a lot of money, just a little bit of thought and time. But it was like the real, I think, pivot point in the articulation of the work came when the deputy mayor's office got wind of what we were doing and said, hey, you know, do you all want to help us think through chronic absenteeism? And we're like, of course, sure. Now, mind you, I was working full time. So this was something that was like happening after school, I mean, after work. One of the things that we noticed when we were studying chronic absenteeism is that there are lots of kids that are absent. Not every kid is truant. And that we started to see, like, who is truant and who is not, started to cut down very, very clear lines of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status. Like, it was so very, very clear. So, you know, I was like, so what has to be true of our innovation frameworks to solve problems that are rooted in systemic oppression and injustice? Then I was like, oh, no, that's the question. Because that means that the things that we're seeing and observing have been designed. It also means that they could be redesigned. But it means that we have to do something different to do the redesign. So that framework was written, you know, it probably stands on the shoulders of a lot of work that came before it. Not new, maybe new for this time. Right.
Yes.
But I think the opportunity at this particular moment, not just in our country, I will say in our country, is that once our schools went through the desegregation process, they were never integrated or designed for equity.
Sure.
So those are two very different processes. To desegregate something and then to integrate and design for equity are just two different schemas. And I think I'm going to give folks the benefit of the doubt. They might have thought that one begets the other.
It's generous.
Yeah, but it's very generous. That's why I'm being political here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's an opportunity here for us to say, like, how do we design our schools for the most marginalized and ask ourselves the critical question, like, what has to be true of the most marginalized, most excluded? Like, I like to use the example of a poor trans girl of color whose parents don't speak English. What has to be true for her to rise to the presidency? What education experience does she need to rise to the presidency? That's how we should design our schools, as if every kid can get there. right? Yes. Every kid, yes. Not just my daddy was the president, so therefore I can be the president too, right?
Right.
And I think we are having examples of that now. Like, wow, we have a president that didn't attend an Ivy League school in the White House. That's powerful. Because there's so many other children who don't go to those schools than kids who do, right? And it's like, and for us to be able to see ourselves as people who can participate in the democracy is so very important. So that's like kind of the hallmark of the work now of the accelerator is to one, have teachers and leaders think about themselves as designers, right? You can change the structures. One, be able to see the structures and what they're doing and knowing that without any intention, they'll do exactly what they were designed to do, which is to have a few pass through, but not everybody. And a part of being a leader in this moment is not just saying that you have a commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, but also having your actions and your designs follow. But educators need help with that, right? And not in like in a pejorative way need help. It's like, one, very few of us are even trained to think about ourselves as designers, or two, that we even have the creative authority to challenge the structures that currently exist. And for a school system or for a school unit to change, it's not just the teachers. It has to be the teachers and the principal. Everyone has to work together and be on the same page. So a lot of our work right now is like building that capacity as a designer and giving them a pathway to follow, to start to think differently about their structures and processes, how they interact with students, how they interact with families, and redesigning them, you know, bit by bit to become more equitable and redesign those relationships that the school has within the community. That was a mouthful.
And I love it though. That's I have like 152 different things going through my mind right now and just all these questions. And I almost want to take a step back and just kind of, because you're talking about the work that you're doing now, but then also you started, as you said, creating a system that didn't work, right? Yeah. That wasn't working for everybody, and then went through a redesign process yourself. Yeah. And so I'm curious if you could just kind of maybe, let's start there and kind of explore what was that like to be able to have that moment, like you said, like, I'm woke, guys, this should be happening, to actually say, well, let's rethink it though. How do you go through that process to actually pause and make that shift? Because that's a monumental shift for many people, and it doesn't happen just by chance.
Yeah, so I would say it's two things. I think tons of educators have that shift, right? They're like, oh, what's happening, right? This is happening on my watch, whoa. But I think what's also important, and I feel very, very privileged to have, you know, an education ecosystem that created space for leaders to think about that. So we were a part of the Education Innovation Fellowship that City Bridge ran starting in 2013. So we had one of our teachers in that. We had a teacher in that for like 3 years. Mm-hmm. So we at least had one teacher who could take a day out of a month to sit and reflect on the operations of the school and the practice. And then the way that fellowship for that teacher was designed is that the principal came for half a day, mm-hmm. right? So I could sit with one of the teachers, his name is Shane Donovan. He works at DCI, I think. We would sit there and talk about, so what's not working? So what do we do about it? What can we do about it? You know, and that space and time away from the school allowed for two things. One, to clear our heads, but also we could bring back new ideas. We could bring back new ideas. So then I think that also being a part of the Breakthrough Schools network in DC also created more space and time for us to think. Because oftentimes the pace at which school leaders and also teachers have to move, it gives enough time for, like, you get those insights at home.
Right.
You get those insights in the summer, but then there's not a lot of time to change direction, change behavior, right? So I'm really, really thankful and fortunate to be able to have, you know, one, the education ecosystem in DC, be mature enough to create spaces for leaders to do that thinking mm-hmm. so that when there's a need to change direction, there's space to change direction, right? I think that was definitely critical in our pathway of even designing and thinking about what did we want to build that looks completely different than what currently exists, but based on what we saw our kids needed and where they said they wanted to go.
Yeah. And that's the real power there too. Like you said, involving the students, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So you create an entire school without having started from that place. And then we're like, wait, oh my goodness, it's not working for everybody. Well, what if we actually ask everybody what they need? Right. And so it's that shift in allowing the students who are the reason that we're all here in the room in the school to have that voice. And so I'm curious, what did that look like when you actually started giving students that voice? I mean, was it like, oh, everything just went smoothly? Here's our voice. Here's what we need. Here's what we want. Let's do it. Or what did that process actually look like for the students?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you start a school from the ground up, because when you have a school and it's just 10 teachers and 100 kids, they get to know, they see everything.
Yes.
they see everything. You go through everything like a family. So they were very, very comfortable saying what worked and what didn't work. And I think that's one of the most, it's a beautiful characteristic of really small learning and intimate learning spaces. I mean, it tickled me. I would see kids like, oh, you don't have your shoes on. It's like, oh, because I'm at home. I was like, okay, I can dig it. Like, you're at home. And so they would say, this is not working, or we don't like this. But I also think that we created a really thoughtful curriculum that activated student voice. And by the end, I think by 2015, 2016, discussions about race, equity, and diversity and inclusion migrated not just from the teacher's discourse to the student's discourse. And we had a civil rights tour of the South that continued, like started in maybe 2012, 2013. Like, we would take kids from DC all the way down to Mississippi. So like, you could understand and it was a part of our American history curriculum. Wow. And I think those intimate relationships allowed voice to be activated, because like the more time you spend with someone in a respectful relationship, that hierarchy flattens, and people are more willing to share with you what they think. So I think that's not like it's more like, you know, that trust that was built over time.
Right. Yeah. And I love that phrase that you're saying of activating student voices.
Yeah.
Because it changes the dynamics, like you said. It's not we're dictating to you, we're teaching to you, but it's that education is about empowering you and allowing us to work together to get what you need in your journeys. And so when you did the redesign with the students at the center here, and you were thinking about what is happening that's allowing for the success of all of our students, are there kind of like things you could kind of distill it down to? Did you notice trends? Were you noticing like, oh, by doing this, we were allowing, or was it just kind of like because there was that trust relationship and the activation?
No, I mean, I think, let me see if I understand your question. Are you saying like, were there different moves that we made to create experiences for students to be successful?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I firmly believe in competency-based education and mastery-based education. It does not always happen in 1 year. So I think, you know, we started to figure out like saying that mastery was the goal and giving kids chance. Now, don't get me wrong, it was messy. Like, one of the things that we started playing around with even the first year was the idea of reassessment. And it's like, if you don't get it right, study and take it again and again. And again, because what's most important is that, you know, you master the content as it's as demonstrated, you know, using these tools. That's a push on teacher practice, though.
Yes.
Like, because you can't give a child three chances to reassess a test with the same tool.
Right.
I mean, you can, but like, you didn't learn the tool, and then you're not really you're assessing mastery of the tool and not mastery of the content. So I think like when we were tinkering around the edges, like reassessment, like we did it knowing that it was going to be messy, but trying to figure out how we give kids chances. And I think that that was probably one of the more student friendly policies that we had. That really, I mean, it was hard.
Right.
I mean, and it what was interesting about it, then you also, what I realized is like how fallible are all the things in schools we say are, like, you can't touch. Like, you can change a transcript. You can. You can change a report card. You can. Like, nothing is firm.
Yeah.
You just make it that way. And not saying that these tools don't have integrity. I'm not saying that at all.
Right.
But it's like, if I mean, I've had experiences as a learner that it didn't click for me until right before the final exam. And if I'm able to demonstrate mastery on the final exam, should I fail the class because I didn't get it up until that point? And that doesn't make sense.
Right. Right.
But yet we have kids right now who didn't understand the importance of grades 9 through 12 until the 12th grade year.
Yeah.
But can't go to, or not in college, or didn't go to college because they didn't understand, like, oh, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade really matter? Yeah. I wasn't mature enough. Like, you know, and I think, like, that is, we can do better than that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a fundamental shift too, in the way that, like, in my mind, I'm hearing it's like we're redefining failure to perseverance and to being able to set and achieve your goals, which might look different from how the person next to you is setting and achieving their goals. But it's that process of being able to set your own goals and that satisfaction that comes with knowing that you've achieved them that I think is what we're valuing. And it's a shift in what we value as a school and as a system almost.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've learned a lot about this firsthand by, you know, in my yoga practice. It's like, everyone's going to fall down or fall out of a posture. The question is, do you get back up?
If,
you know, yes. When you fall down, do you just like, I can't do this, or do you get back up and try again? And I think there's a lot of pedagogical lessons we can learn by learning other, by working and learning other disciplines. I was like, pedagogically, this makes sense. Like, I should be rewarded for getting back up, not right. For getting it right the first time.
Right.
Because no one gets it right the first time, right?
Right. It's that myth that you were talking about, what is fallible and what's not. What's infallible is, yeah, you know, you have to get it right the first time or else.
You know, we're in class, and I remember one of my yoga instructors said this. There was one posture, and she was like, I've only seen someone, I've been teaching for 15 years. She said, I've only seen someone do this right the first time. One person.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you think about that, like if a professional instructor has only seen one person get it right the first time out of teaching thousands of classes, then when we reward performance and not process, we miss the point. And I think that's a cultural shift and challenge that we probably have to work on in this country.
Sure. Yes, I'd agree with that. And I think, like you were saying too, it goes back to our pedagogy as teachers as well, and how we think about what we need to do as teachers too, right? Because if our mindset is, if I have a student fail this, then I'm going to be judged. I'm going to look like a bad teacher. I did a poor job. Then our whole focus is on doing just enough so that nobody fails as the assessment. Mm-hmm. Instead of, you know, if my job is to make sure that everybody's understanding and accessing the material and being able to show what they know, then it shifts to a collaborative relationship that allows it to be about the end product being a performative ability to say, I understand this, I can show it, instead of in this moment right now in time, are you going to be able to pass or fail this assessment?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so when you talk about redesigning and rethinking the systems, what does that look like? How did that get you to a accelerator where you're basically making this your professional life to allow people and schools and institutions to have the time, space, the energy to put equity at the center of what they do?
So are you asking, how did we get from, can you repeat your question? Make sure I get it right before I respond.
Sure. So it's just, I'm curious as to when you're doing the rethinking and the reimagining, as you talked about, and kind of that fundamental shift to put equity at the center of the redesign or the actual design process, if you're starting from the very beginning, what does that look like and how did that become, you know, kind of your daily life, so to speak?
Yeah. So I think what I think any professional needs is time and network and resources, right? To change behavior. You need to create the time to do it. You need people to do it with, and you need a different set of instructions. I learned that, I mean, between the principalship and working, you know, with the accelerator, I led the school creation and transformation work at City Bridge Education. And managing those investments for school redesign and a new school startup. And I think I saw firsthand what a school leader would need to do and constraints under which they were. I mean, like I experienced it, but it was like, but then it was like, oh, how do I help people do this? The idea of community is so very important to challenge, to one that have a shoulder to cry on, but also a community to challenge what your assumptions. So I think, and then what I also noticed, it was that, and at the time when I made the transition from City Bridge Education to the accelerator, that was when the discourse around diversity, equity, and inclusion was really becoming more mainstream in education circles. But there was not a lot of coherence about what it meant in practice and action. And immediately the discourse jumped to discipline. I was like, oh, there's so much more than just discipline.
Yeah.
Right. And then said like, well, a framework's not enough. The framework has to be articulated into how a school works if the framework is going to be of any value to people. So the work of the accelerator is articulating the equity by design framework in the context of schools. Like, what does it mean to start with yourself? How do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as a designer? If you don't, why not? Like, who told you that you weren't a designer? And you know, what is it? And I think one of the things that, because language and discourse is so very important, like most of the issues around equity are, they're issues of, we don't believe in radical inclusion, that the table's big enough for everybody, right? There's enough for everybody. There's enough for every story. There's enough for literally everybody. And I think that then, if you believe in radical inclusion and you have a school that says it believes in radical inclusion, then you got to figure out then what does it mean that we, you know, have our, you know, our special needs children not in the inclusion classroom. Like, oh, there's dissonance there. Or if we believe in radical inclusion, then is this a safe space for all bodies to be in the school? You know, like it starts to get down to not just these big platitudes like, oh, everybody belongs. So no, what are the actions that people are taking on the ground every single day that you either create an experience of belonging or create an experience of exclusion, because that's where our beliefs manifest. Our beliefs don't manifest in our mission statements. Our beliefs manifest in our relationships and how, you know, who we connect with. And I think that's where the work is. It's like, so you can say this, but that's not what you do.
Right.
So,
right.
But I think that behavior change is so very important, because oftentimes people aren't even aware of what they do. And that's when it's like, you have to extend grace. I was like, did you know you were doing that? It's one thing if you're like, oh, I knew I was doing that. I was like, that's different. Like, that's a different set of prescriptions. But for most people, it's like, I did know I was doing it and I didn't know the impact. And I would say for most people, once you say that, one, this is what you're doing, this is how it's hurting somebody else, and this is the pathway to do something different, most people will be like, oh, I'm going to work at that. Not going to be perfect at it, but I'm going to work at that. So I think, like, at least for this particular season, I think like helping school folks see the way they can articulate equity and the ideas of radical inclusion in their behaviors. And you know, I'll tell a quick story. I was talking to a school leader in Georgia, and he was like, yeah, so I want to redesign my communication plan with my parents. And we were just talking. And then I said, well, what are you going to do first? He said, well, you know, I'll run this by with my assistant principal, and we'll write the goals. And then we'll circulate to the teachers. And I was like, well, why don't you just test your idea with 5 marginalized students first? He was like, oh, I said, yeah, have them in your office and have them get on the phone and call their families and ask their families what they think.
Yeah.
He was like, I can do that. You know, and it wasn't even like a resistance. I mean, we're not trained to think that way.
Right. Right.
And his way of solving the problem was not a wrong way. It just would not have gotten him to where he could have gone quicker if he had just gone right to that bleeding edge to say, like, who's not doing well in my school? Who do I have to call home? Let's get the feedback from them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's asking the right questions and knowing how to get the right answers that we weren't necessarily trained to do, like you said, because, you know, when you think about the system of education as a whole, like that idea to take some of your marginalized students and incorporate them hasn't been at the forefront of our systems, right?
No. And I think there's an opportunity here. One of the ideas I've been thinking about a lot is that, so you had schools before the civil rights era, and then you had schools in the desegregation and the post-civil rights era. We're in that post-civil rights era, right? Mm-hmm. But if studying Black schools in the pre-civil rights era and the segregated schools of the South, like the notion of being educated to practice democratic life was core to the school design process. I have not heard that be a core design principle of many of the schools that are operating. But if you're like, the reason why you go to school is to lead democracy, the reason why you go to school is to include the excluded, is that you could, like, then you do start with the excluded, right? And that is a whole different value proposition to why you learn to read at the highest levels, right? Yes. A whole different, and I was like, I wish someone would have told me that. Someone just said, you know, and I think what we're seeing with the disengagement with a lot of kids, it's like, if I can go make $1 million on YouTube, tell me why I need to do this again.
Right. Right.
Tell me why. And I was like, right. Yeah. Real talk. Good point.
Yeah. Yeah. It goes back to that. Like you said, the finding meaning, right?
Right. And I think like the economic argument, I think is played. Mm. I think we need to have an economic argument for why public schools exist. But then I think there's also like, no, public schools exist because they're the institution that preserved the democracy. And each one of you all are important and you count, right?
Yes.
So that's why you learn not just one literacy, but several. So you can make sure that all the people who have been excluded are included. And what a noble job, yes. Right? In anything that you choose to do, whether you choose to be, you know, a songwriter, or whether you choose to be a doctor, like there, you can always work on that. And I think like there's an opportunity in this particular moment to reevaluate the value proposition.
Yeah, and I think that the interesting thing too, as you said, is when you think about if the goal is democracy in action, so to speak, where that it's of the people, by the people, for the people, which, you know, is what the claim has been.
Right.
And you also need to look at that in this country itself, there's been exclusionary practices.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's when you talk about like when we're rethinking and redesigning and thinking about how we be inclusive and how do we work towards equity, it is understanding that, you know, the origins of the systems itself were not meant for Black people in this country. We're not meant for people of color or Indigenous people in this country. And so when we are rethinking equity and when we are working towards these goals, I think that it is being able to say we might have this same goal, but it's changed what that actually means. Who's included? Who's at the table, so to speak? That aspect of it. So you talked about not understanding the definitions of diversity, equity, inclusion, and then not understanding them in practice. So I'm wondering, yeah, maybe we could maybe dive a little bit deeper into some of those aspects too.
Yeah, I think we're in this really, really interesting moment. And I wrote about it on one of the blogs that we have on our site, but like, this is like the first time that the only thing that's separating schools is a Zoom link, right? And like, that's the only thing that separates a kid in Southeast DC from a kid in Cambridge. So the question is like, do we want to share the links, right? And mm-hmm. and I think that that's both a literal and a philosophical question, because if it's important for us to use our public school system to build and support our democracy, like we could have sister schools across the entire country, right? Imagine that there's a school in Idaho that's partnered with a school in Washington, DC on purpose. And you all are working together on a project on purpose. Mm. And you can't master this competency without working with someone who you don't live with or know or who doesn't live in your zip code. Mm. Like, how dope is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, that requires literally to have, I mean, like, I think we can keep our fingers crossed. Like, I think there might be so much confusion whether we'll get that kind of leadership coming from the Most High. We might get it, who knows? But I think that there are opportunities for school. There's nothing stopping teachers from doing that now.
Right.
There's nothing stopping school leaders from doing that now to say, hey, let's just do a project together and let's just test this out. I got your classroom, my classroom, two third grade classrooms. Let's just have coffee together. I just think about the opportunity we have in this moment that COVID has. I mean, there's been a lot of things that we've learned about ourselves, but this idea, like, and I think, like, in terms of value, if kids aren't like, the big question, Josh, comes down to, are we willing to challenge the caste system?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are we willing to challenge the caste system and deconstruct it, right? Because it's not serving everybody. And the education system holds it up.
Yeah.
And I think that's a question that we all have to be able to wrestle with, especially for the folks who benefited from the caste system in any way. Because, and I think like that those are hard philosophical questions. Like, do we really want everyone to belong?
Yeah. Right.
Do we really want everyone to be able? I mean, like, and I think that's the courageous is like answer is yes, because the cost of it is too great. The cost of humanity is too great.
Hmm. Yeah.
Hi, Carolyn. Michael here. Michael. So sorry to be like so fashionably late.
Oh no, it's fine.
But I was so excited. I'm gonna go back and listen. But you, I wanted to ask. Can I ask you a question? Yes. You don't know me, no. The question was like, because I love that you know what stopped. Like, I guess the question is, what's stopping? Like, why aren't school leaders sending the Zoom links out? Collaborating using the internet more, like what's the thing, or what are the things that, you know, are just like the little hurdles? Because I think they're little. I don't think they're big hurdles.
They're not. They're yeah. So I think there are a couple of things. I think that and I've seen this, like, most of the barriers that we've put up to separate ourselves are fragile. They don't look fragile though.
Ooh.
But they're fragile, and you don't know that they're fragile until you poke at it. Like, wait a minute, they just fell down just like that. Oh, what else can I? And I think that there's been a lot of fear to say, like, don't cross that line. Don't poke that barrier. So then you don't have. So then I think, like, we haven't created the muscle of pushing the boundary a little bit. And I think that this is a moment where we can do it. We have the technology to do it. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that, you know, some of the work of the accelerators, like, we're seeding those ideas. It's like, so if you have the Zoom link, why haven't you used it? Like, Like, why haven't you just called a professor at the most elite school and say, hey, can we do a project together? Mm-hmm. And I think like some of it is like, I just, people are one, whenever there are these moments where you have these opportunities to shape shift, there's also a lot of grief that's along with it. So they, people are grieving right now. I think they're grieving from a lot of loss that's happened over the past 12 months. But I also think that there is, and you know, you hear in a lot of like rhetoric right now, it's like, oh, when things go back to normal, I was like, ooh, they're not. They're not. So I also think that there's this feeling of wanting to hold on tightly to the past because you know it and you've experienced it, but you have to have the faith that what's over there is so much better because we're all going to get there together. So, I mean, I think that's it's to answer your question, Michael, in a shorter sense, it's like people just need support changing behavior of walking across the line with someone else holding their hand and saying like, you know what, if they push back on you, they're going to push back on me too. You're not by yourself on this. And I think just supporting teachers when they're doing that and just supporting leaders when they're doing it and saying, hey, you guys, y'all all crossed that boundary, not by yourself, but all of you all together do it.
Mm-hmm. I hear in there that there's a vulnerability that needs support.
Oh yeah. 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 And you know, and I think that just, I think we have, I mean, we've built these social hierarchies. They don't really exist. Mm-hmm. And we've built systems to make them feel realer than they are. But it's so interesting. Like, but we all know in our most intimate relationships, mm-hmm. that they, I was like, but wait a minute. There's this dissonance between the way we interact and the way we're told to the way we're told our relationships are designed and structured.
Right.
And I think that it's important for us to reconcile that, to scale the beauty that we are experiencing in our daily lives and make that the national story. Mm-hmm. And that's our schools.
Yeah. Yeah. Schools. Whew, schools have a lot of power. People don't.
Oh, so much.
Predictive programming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what are, in your work with accelerators and with encouraging educators, what are some of those, you know, I'm thinking about like, because you use that metaphor of like, you got to stretch the muscle of reaching out, of collaborating mm-hmm. with others that might not be the same as you or maybe different. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm just thinking of those people that, you know, the first couple of times they go to the gym, it feels like failure. But what are the little encouraging things that you in your work or others around you use to kind of strengthen the muscle in the start?
I think one of the learning experiences that we walk educators through is to actually like interrogate your own story, right? And one of my favorite quotes, I'm gonna paraphrase it, but it goes something like this, like you can't have two curriculums with competing teachers. That creates fluctuation and volatility, but you can't change direction, right? And I think for a lot of folks, like the dissonance is like, I've gotten two messages. And I think what folks need to understand, they need to be able to say, when in my life have I gotten two messages and I made a decision? I've chosen one message, right? And what happened when I did that?
Yeah.
And did my head explode? Like, no. like I was talking to one teacher, he was like, no, when I made the decision to do this, that's when the volatility stopped. That's when my own internal fluctuation stopped. And I grew up taller. I was like, that's what happens. At any moment that you, in a moment of volatility or fluctuation, you make a decision, then there's an opportunity for growth on the other side. So I think helping educators see, like, you know how to do this. You've done it before. I'm just asking you to do that transfer of that skill to this setting.
Yeah, it's giving permission, right? It's giving them permission to do what they already know is right and know how to do. Like you said, like here's the Zoom link, send it out.
Right, right. And it's like, it could have been, you know, for some people, it was like, when I decided this is who I wanted to marry, I was like, yep, you brought that person home. There could have been total pushback, but you're like, no, I'm telling you this because this is what I'm going to do.
Right.
You can do it with me or not.
Right.
But this is what I'm going to do, or when I'm going to go to this school. And I think what you find out was that when you have people who have not followed their own internal messaging, but they've been told what to do by whether it was a parent or parent figure, or like, oh, I just did this because this is what my pastor said, or I just did this because this is what my dad said, then like that muscle's weak.
Mm-hmm.
That muscle's weak, because it's like, Cindy, who are you? If you've only done what people told you to do, not you didn't do it because that's what you decided to do. Mm-hmm. So educators just need help understanding that they have that muscle already.
Yeah.
And that needs to be exercised in this space.
And so how, I'm an educator, I'm starting a school, I'm in education. How do I get to 228X Accelerator? What am I looking for there? The questions that you're asking, how do I get more of those if I'm in education?
Yeah. So if you're an educator, I mean, I would check out our Equity by Design Learning Studio. We have this really ambitious goal of having our work touch all 50 states and 5 million kids in 5 years or less, right? Mm-hmm. So which means we got to scale,
yes.
And which means we need a technology solution. So a lot of our course experiences are online, and you can access them at 228 Accelerator and become a part of our growing community of hundreds of educators that are also designing for equity. And one of the things I've realized and noticed is that educators need community and a network, and especially when it comes to work around diversity, equity, and inclusion, a private space to practice. Because this is the work that requires you to practice in public, but because discourse is so volatile right now in our country, if you say the wrong thing because you're learning, you'll have the whole world against you. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily invite or encourage people to practice, right? So it's like practice in private public, right? Come to the community, work it out, right? And the whole goal of the course is to help you work out your stuff.
Right.
Slowly but surely deal with the dissonance. Like if you need to take a walk, the course says, at this point, go take a walk. Reflect on what you're feeling. Now come back and answer the question. You know, it's like it walks you through so that you stay engaged in your own development. So check it out, Learning Equity by Design Learning Studio, 228accelerator.com. And thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Caroline. This has been just phenomenal. I loved our conversation. I loved everything that you have to say, and just the way that you're thinking about equity, the way that you're bringing it to the forefront, the way that you're creating this movement, and let's do it. Let's do it. 5 million people across 50 states in 5 years or less. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Thank you so much, Josh and Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Josh and I hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode of Amplifying Optimism in Education. Please join us next week for another new episode and conversation with an innovative educator from around the world.